I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, welcome back to In The Pink. Thank you so much for your feedback on recent podcasts. It's a great way to stay connected in this lockdown, isn't it? Talking to people and then talking about the people that we've talked to. So I've had loads of great feedback from you. We've got a couple more winners of those Bose noise-cancelling headphones. I'll be announcing that very soon. And we've got some great guests coming up. Thank you for your feedback on Graham Swan. He gave some really descriptive anecdotes about his time playing for England, didn't he? And if you like your cricket, then we've got Johnny Bairstow on the way. Right, next up on In The Pink is a man who's been part of the F1 family for many, many years. However, doesn't work in the sport. He is a Hollywood actor, most famous for Game of Thrones, Sir Davos. You, of course, now know I'm talking about Liam Cunningham. He's been a massive fan of Formula One for pretty much all his life, and that is a very rich and interesting life that he has led that's taken him to all corners of the earth, mostly in acting, but also before that, as an electrician. He has got some awesome stories to share, and he does exactly that on In The Pink, so I hope you enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, Liam Cunningham. Liam Cunningham, it is great to see your face and hear your voice. How are you? How are you coping? Where are you?
Oh, I'm in, can't you tell, Natalie? I'm in my gated community in Hollywood. No, I'm not. I'm in Dublin. I'm back in my home that I've been in for 30-odd years. And same as everybody else, going slowly mad.
It's bonkers, isn't it? And you know, you say 30 years. Is it actually the same bricks and mortar that whole time, that even though you're this big star now?
Yeah, I know. I do get accused occasionally because I do whinge and moan about politics and stuff, and I do some, you know, stuff for refugees and all that, that it's okay for you and your... that's when they bring out the gated community in Hollywood. It's all right for you in Hollywood and your gated community. I've been in the same house for the last 30-odd years. I keep my life simple, Natalie. It allows me to save up and go to Formula One races.
And you need a big budget for that.
One does.
More of that later. Tell me about your childhood and tell me about growing up in Dublin.
You know what? I had a completely idyllic childhood. And you know what? There's a saying that I love, that I once knew a man who was so poor that all he had was money. I was the opposite. I was extremely... my dad is very blue-collar, working-class background. So was I. But I was surrounded by, you know, three sisters and a brother and a mother who will, when she passes, will take over God's job. She's so magnificent. And we were just surrounded by love and with not much of anything else. So I think I'm reasonably well adjusted because of that. So I had a cool childhood playing on a ball, not much, you know, playing with somebody else's football usually. Lots of friends around, just a ordinary working class blue collar upbringing. It was rather lovely.
And in fact, you were at one point destined to be, and well, were an electrician, but that's the path that you were
that you were going on, what, for as a lifetime job, or what is it? How did you see it?
I did that for 11 years. I didn't start acting until I was 29. Africa was the reason for that. I went to live in Africa. My first time on an airplane was going to Africa. I was married before I was on a plane, yet I go back to the blue collar thing. 3.5 years working in the bush. And for a year and a half, one of the areas I looked after was a safari park, the national park in Zimbabwe, which is the size of Belgium, 16,000 elephants. So when it was a little electrician coming along from Dublin who's got given a Land Rover Defender and driving around looking after the big five. I was putting in wells and boreholes for animals and all that sort of thing. So a little bit of culture shock.
That's incredible. What an opportunity. How did it come about?
Yeah. It was 4 years. This is years before you were born, Natalie. It was 1984. That was 4 years after independence and with the exodus of the white population after Robert Mugabe came to power. They had, and the whites kept all the good jobs for themselves, as they did in South Africa. They all started to leave. So they were short. They didn't have people to run their networks. So that's what I used to do. I used to do kind of high voltage. Actually, if you remember Close Encounters of the Third Kind, do you remember that wonderful movie, that Steven Spielberg movie? The one with the aliens, the famous.
I need to see it. Terrible,
oh,
it?
For God's sake. It's a classic. It's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant movie. Anyway, the start of that.
My lockdown viewing.
Yes, you should. It's a brilliant, brilliant movie. So the job that Richard Dreyfuss does in the start of that, out in his van with his ladders looking after all the electricity. Basically, I did the job that Richard Dreyfuss did in Close Encounters. So I did have 3.5 years, came back to my little van driving around Dublin.
Why did you come back?
It was a 3.5 year contract.
Right.
Or a 3 year contract, and I stayed an extra few months. And they offered me promotion, offered me all sorts of things to stay, but it started to feel like home. And I didn't want two homes. I really thought that if I was in Dublin, I'd miss there, and if I was there, I'd miss Dublin. I was already missing Dublin. So I didn't want to be stuck in the middle. You know what I mean? I didn't want to be not happy anywhere. So I came back and realized after a month that maybe I hadn't made the right decision. And so I was looking for a hobby. And there was an ad on the back of a newspaper for an acting school. So I did it literally just as a distraction, just to keep my, you know, keep the boredom at bay. And then I just, when I started doing it, I started falling in love with it. It turned into something I didn't imagine it would be. I just loved the problem solving. And then as it went on, I started to notice, when I started going to F1, I started to notice how similar the lifestyles are. The circus, the getting on planes, the traveling, the hitting somewhere, the mental amount of work, and then getting the hell out of there and going somewhere else on the next job. And so I feel a certain, as regards the circus aspect of it, I feel a huge amount of affinity to it, because I kind of, you know, same in your game, same in F1, same in my game, you kind of, it attracts misfits. But I mean that, I mean that in the best sense, you know, people that don't fit into the normal 9-to-5 office, whatever it may be, and God bless them. If they're happy with that, then I'm delighted for them. I wasn't, so I had to do something else.
That's so true. So you were driven by the excitement of it all, and there's an element of jeopardy to it, isn't there? You don't know where your next job's coming from, but that keeps you on your toes.
Oh yeah, it does keep you on your toes. It keeps the tummy rumbling. Yeah.
Do you have any aspirations before that course to be an actor? Like, even when you were young, did you put on shows for the family, or were you a show pony? Did you like the escapism of acting?
No, it was completely for survival tactics in school. Because of my socioeconomic bracket, there was a couple of naughty boys, as there is in all these troublesome schools. So I took the class clown route. So my performing was to protect my ass, as they say. So I you learn to tell jokes, and I was kind of small and I was a late developer and stuff like that. So I was easy to pick on. So the only way around that was to be kind of class clown. So I think that helped. I did my apprenticeship trying to save myself from getting the crap beaten out of me, you know.
And when did you realize that actually you're onto something here? You were pretty good at it and you could potentially make a career out of it?
Well, naivety is a wonderful thing. I was enjoying it so much that I never thought that I could feed myself or anything like that. I was just so hungry for knowledge of how to do it and how to do it properly. And you know, instinct is very important, as is luck. But it seemed to feed my instincts, the acting thing, and I like the collaborative aspect, because it is, you know, same as F1, it's a big team thing, and it doesn't take much to bring the whole house of cards down. So I love that aspect of it, and it just it's bizarre. It just seemed to suit me. Do you know what I mean? I found something that suited me.
Yeah.
And 30 years later that I'm doing it, I still have the same kind of passion for it. I'm still embarrassed about people, you know, who haven't seen anything I've done. They go, you know, so what is it you're doing? Through gritted, clenched teeth, I tell them I'm an actor. It just seems so pretentious, even to me now, doing it 30 years. I love acting. I love the process. I love the, you know, seeing the results. I love hearing the screams and laughter of people when they see the work and all that sort of stuff, and occasionally making people question their preconceptions about things. I love all that sort of stuff, but as I say, it just kind of, you know, I just took to it. I just took to it. Like, I had a voracious appetite for my lack of knowledge about the process. That's fun.
It's interesting how acting can offer so much and be so individual, I suppose, in the sense that people get into it for such different reasons. Some fame hungry, and there's obviously some that would argue there's that narcissistic element to it. But something you put on there was the collaborative element to it, the team side, something that you thrived on, but also just shifting perception. I love that as an idea, that you're able to act as a conduit for that. You're able to actually influence, and you also touched on earlier, you're quite politically charged. So it's obviously in you to want to make a difference in some way, and you found acting doing that.
Yeah, acting is really, it's really cool. I mean, I still am of the opinion that I was a lot more useful to society when I was an electrician. I could actually make people's, like, practical problems go away, you know, when they'd no electricity, the joy and that you'd bring to people. There is a weirdness to that. I remember when I was in Africa, one of the greatest joys that I have was, because I barely was on a tarmac road. It was all, you know, degraded road, dust roads and all that. And I used to go to these, literally these mud-built villages. And I used to love doing this for the ladies. You've seen it on Nat Geo stuff and all that. It's like a mortar and pestle, but a huge one, with these ladies smashing down the maize to try and make this mealy meal. They call it sadza, they used to call it. It's a bit like polenta. But they would have to hammer this stuff, and it's very physical work. And I had the great pleasure of some people would come before me, and they would build a little hut, like a garden shed. And inside there was a motor, electric motor, with a milling machine. But we'd never tell them. I used to always tell the guys, don't tell them what we're doing. So the people would arrive, and these were usually government-funded things, put them in, and then I would go along and connect them up because of the high-voltage electricity. And then I would say to the ladies, can somebody bring me a 50-kilo bag of maize? And they would look at me and go, okay. And they would bring it along. And I would fill this hopper at the top after connecting it. And I'd go, can you get the ladies? And I'd get all the ladies in the square, and they would be all wondering, what is this white guy doing here in his van, in his Land Rover? And I would let them see me filling the hopper, and then I would flick the switch, and in like 15 seconds, 50-kilo bag would go into a bag underneath. And I used to bring the bag out, and the ladies would just look. There would be this silence, this wide eye. They would look at each other and start squealing for joy. because I just given them basically a half a day of every day free that they could go. And of course, as we know, the women just did most of the work in these villages. Could go and plant, they could go and dig.
Not just
yeah, I know, everywhere. Yeah, I know. That's my point. And they would go and they would have a free half their day would be free. And so I had gorgeous moments like that. So they would be nearly crying coming up to me, the ladies. It was really, the job satisfaction was really cool.
I tell you what,
so I used to get things like that.
You're a great storyteller, because I had such strong images then of everything you just described. That's beautiful. And when did you feel that your first break came in acting? When was the role that you really first punched the air to?
It's kind of funny, because when I started up, the guys that in the acting school came to me at the end of 2 years and go, look, you've no choice, you have to go for it, you know, just because I was showing promise or whatever. And then I went to do some electrical work for a theatre company. After, I wanted to see the day in, day out, literally the practice of getting a show together, a theatre show. And as luck would have it, one of the guys got a rather well-paid job in a television show while he was supposed to be doing this play. And it was a play about a guy who'd been away from Ireland, Dublin, working class, drove a motorbike. I was driving it my Ducati at the time. And the lead guy disappeared to the very large annoyance of the theatre director. He was also my year head for my second year. And he said, do you want to get in here and do this? So literally, I was plucked, Natalie. and I did that. And then, literally a couple of people. So 6 months after I started, after I kind of jacked the job, as we say, somebody from the Royal Court came over and saw me in a play. And I was offered a two-hander in the Royal Court in Sloane Square on the main stage. And I'd never even been in a theatre in England. Never mind. My first time in a theatre in England was on the main stage in the Royal Court in Sloane Square.
I know exactly where you mean.
So from there, I went back to the Bush Theatre, and I was doing a trilogy of Irish plays there, and some BBC producers saw me, and I was whisked, and my first kind of break, I suppose, at the BBC was a thing called Roughnecks, which was about oil rig workers in the North Sea. And we had some wonderful people in that, Ricky Tomlinson and all sorts of people. Yeah, it was really cool. So we filmed on an oil rig in the North Sea. Yeah, that'll drive you mad.
Right, it will. Tell me one thing, really simple question. When you're on stage, this is a bit different when it's television or film, but have you ever had a moment where you've forgotten your lines? And what do you do? What mechanisms do actors have to learn lines?
I've had two spectacular disasters. My first performance in the Royal Court in Sloane Square, as I was telling you, it was a political two-handers, basically two actors on stage. And when they were pulling up the safety curtain, it got stuck just as we were about to go on. We had no previews. My first, the press night, you know, every theatre, you get previews, right? So you get the show up to speed and whatever, and they didn't have time for it. So my first time ever doing it in front of was when the press were in, which is deeply, deeply mean to do to an actor, to do to anybody. And the curtain wouldn't come up. And we stood in the wings for 35 minutes because they couldn't find the electrical motor went to lift up this heavy fire curtain. And they couldn't find the handle.
I was going to say, but you could probably fix that given your ability.
Not when you're about to, when you're already buttock clenched before you go on, shall we say. And I went on so full of nerves and having to stand in the wings for 35 minutes before we did it. When I went on stage and I started talking, there's a famous thing with actors that the voice on your shoulder, I think I have it in a lot of professions, that telling you you're no good and you're going to, you know, you don't deserve it and you're only got here because somebody else died or whatever it may be. And I'd never heard the voice before until I was standing in front of about 800 people in front of stage, and I just started a speech on my own while the other actor is supposed to be in the bathroom in this hotel. And I'm standing there, and I heard, I put my hand on a stack of Bibles and say, "Thus, I heard a voice. It was a real voice. I mean, I know it wasn't, but I, on a stack of Bibles, and I, and just little voice on my shoulder said, you said that already, said that line already. And it was just like, what? It was like I heard someone standing beside me whispering in my ear. You can imagine what that feels like. And I just stopped dead. And it was 2 hours, and then the voice immediately said, just go, just leave. What can I do? Like completely undermining me. And I went, I literally had that conversation. This all probably happened in a space of 2.5-3 seconds. And I just went, where was I? And I continued on. And the next time it hit me, it was stress. That time, first time. And the next time was in front of 1,500 people in Stratford-upon-Avon when I was doing As You Like It. And I have the speech. And in the middle of the speech, I just went just completely blank. I just had no idea what I was saying, what I had been saying, what I was supposed to say, and where I was in the scene. And I did what any true professional does. I started improvising Shakespeare. Yeah. Not even Shakespeare improvised Shakespeare. So I did that for a couple of seconds.
What happened?
I remember, my fellow actress, Niamh Cusack, God bless her, the woman, she was born on stage. Or, you know, she's a dynasty of theatre acting.
Yeah.
And I remember, because it was just me and her on the stage, and I remember her turning like this. As I started improvising Shakespeare, I saw this. Like looking at me like, what are you doing? And I'm looking at her with my eyes pleading, help me, for the love of Jesus, help me. But she was kind of enjoying. I remember thinking, I'm going to strangle you when I get off the stage. So she left me hanging for probably about 5 seconds, and then just came in. It's utterly professional, but enjoyed it just a little too much for my liking, Willa, and was enjoying me. See, I think she was looking at me kind of going, what is this guy going to come out with next? In front of 1,500 people, oh, appalling.
And I bet those 5 seconds felt like an eternity, didn't they?
Oh, forever, man. It felt like I could have, anything. I could have gone to the moon and back in the time it felt, yeah. Horrific. Yeah.
And what about films? I remember seeing you, and it wasn't actually that long ago, but in The Guard.
Did you? Yeah. Oh, I love Megan the Guard. Gorgeous. Yeah, lovely Mark Strong. We were the drug dealers, myself. Well, Brendan Gleeson played the guard, and then myself and glorious Mark Strong as well. It was my first time sort of getting to work with him, and he was an absolute joy. Yeah, in the west of Ireland. Just beautiful writing. And, you know, it's always about the writing with movies and about the story. And it was just wonderfully written and cynical and dark and black comedy, you know, and funnily violent, you know, just ridiculous violent in it. When you read those, when they come in, you kind of go, you get onto your agent and go, no one else is doing this.
What is it about the human psyche that enjoys that kind of dark humor? Because I would never describe myself as enjoying it.
Yeah.
And yet every time I watch it, I laugh. Is it because, I don't know, you can kind of release a bit of tension through that.
It's happening to somebody else. Yeah. It's a bit like somebody, if you know, somebody's, what do we, you know, the old joke is somebody slipping on a banana skin. I mean, it's never not going to be funny. And yet it's somebody else's tragedy, you know. There's a famous, I think it was The Beast from the East. Do you remember that a few years ago? The horrible weather we had when everywhere was iced over, and there was a live newscast that was on Irish news here, and it's gone around the world. It went viral, and you may well have seen it with this guy going. And unfortunately, people have got to be really careful out there. And behind, there's a guy doing this behind like that. Do you remember seeing that? And the guy goes up in the air and comes smack down right over his shoulder. It was like you couldn't have timed it better. And he goes down, well, here's the sense of humor in Ireland. Apparently, I haven't seen it yet, but apparently at the exact spot where that guy fell, they put up a blue plaque to his fall. And it's there forever. This is the man who fell on Irish television news. fell at this point. They've given him his own blue plaque.
It's probably the greatest moment of his life. Do you know, maybe it's such a crazy world and there's a lot of sadness and strife. We just do need to find the humour in these things.
Yeah, you absolutely have to. Listen, there's a few mates of mine, and I know there's a lot of... Listen, everything... I'm the same as everybody else, the same as yourself. The world has kind of stopped for us. Well, when I say the world, you know, the things we do to feed our children and to keep us busy and all that sort of thing. And I'm the same. Everything's fallen out from our perspective, because all the stuff we do is very close and all that, you know.
So you mean work stopped completely?
Completely, absolutely, 100%. Yeah, gone. Everything's gone. And there's two ways of looking at it. You can even either get depressed about it or kind of go, you know what? I have an opportunity to stand back and just kind of reevaluate things and just kind of go, okay, like, what's actually important? And, you know, with the F1 thing, there's so much running around, getting on planes, missing this, missing that. There's a million people would look at the lifestyle that you have and even what I do and kind of go, I don't want that. It's too much grief for what you get. But you sometimes things that are worth doing are worth doing even more because they're difficult, they're tricky, they're not easy. Mm-hmm. And you test yourself. I mean, that's the only thing I'm missing now is a kind of a challenge, you know, at the moment. But I'm actually getting to spend. I'm cooking with my son. I'm constantly every day trying to get my two sons out the back garden to try and change my rainforest, accidental rainforest, to try and dig it up. I'm actually thinking, because God knows how long this will go on for, of planting a few vegetables and, you know, maybe getting a greenhouse or something and all that. Not from survival, for some reason of survival, but actually I've got an opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite fantastic. We've just been planting some tomato seeds and we've started a little herb garden, you know.
Yeah.
Perhaps not the herb that I'd want to be growing, but...
Yeah, that's a bit tricky for everybody at the moment, I believe. So yeah. I hear. Yeah.
Obviously, the massive career seismic shift in your life was Game of Thrones. But you... Yeah. This is going back to sort of, what, 2011, 2012. You came in for
season... Yeah, around that time.
Tell me how that came about and... How did you feel about working in the fantasy genre? That was something pretty new to you.
New to me. It was absolutely new to me. When my agent rang me up and said, look, I have this thing coming over with dragons and this, and I said, let me stop you there. Let me stop you. I think, let me save your breath. And she went, no, Lee, please, read it. And she said, look, it's HBO. People who, you know, made The Sopranos and et cetera, everything. Wonderful, gorgeous stuff. And I said, right, well, I'll give it a read. And when I read it, I went, this is the writing again. It's always the writing. If you're worth your salt, it's always the story. That's how I mainly turn down things, because the stuff's not on the page. And it's about power, it's about legacy, it's about family, it's a bit like, in a strange way, it's a bit like The Sopranos, which I'm just enjoying at the moment. I've never watched it, I'm enjoying it now. It's great. And I really liked that aspect of it, that it was this strange place where these remarkable things happen. We couldn't tell the story that we did tell, set in a modern kind of, you know, three-piece suit world. It wouldn't work. But when I read it, I went up and met them. I said, yeah, I'll have a bit of this. I went up and met them for not the part that I played, another part. And, oh, yeah. They all want to know that. Yeah. No, I'm not telling you. No, it was played brilliantly. They were actually right. They came back to me, and I thought it was the usual Hollywood shake off, you know, the old goodbye. And I said, look, we're going to go another direction with this part, but we want you to come back and have a chat with you for the next season. And I went, yeah. This is don't call us, we'll call you. Surely enough, they called me back and said, look, we're starting a new second season. Will you come up and have a chat with us? And I went up and we did another meeting and I met them again. And hence I ended up as Davos Seaworth, the smuggler. And it's been bizarre. Yes, as I like to say, it took me about 25 years to become an overnight success.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
How surprised are you by just how big Game of Thrones became?
Everyone was. Anybody dares tell you that they knew it was going to be a success is a filthy liar, because nobody knows. That's up to the audience, and usually, and maybe a little help from the critics and stuff. But people, I think people latched onto it because the characters. It was difficult to work them out. We didn't, you know, in our show, the bad guy wasn't wearing the black hat and the good guy wasn't wearing the white hat. And you found yourself, I mean, if you look at the first season with, you know, Ned Stark, and when the guy we've been following as the lead character ends up decapitated before the end of the first season, that's when people went, sorry, what's going on here? You don't kill the leading man. What? And it kind of blew the top off. But it also meant, as a viewer, that all bets were off. Nobody was safe. You couldn't. Where do you put your loyalties? And like Jamie, even who I think you met, Nikolai, gorgeous Danish man.
You brought him to the Monaco Grand Prix.
I did. Yeah, I brought it. Yes, I was the ugliest one there. Yes, I brought Kit Harington, and I brought Nikolai Coster-Waldau too, as my mother would call them, handsome Harrys. I brought them with me, and then Julie discovered that I became invisible. but Nicolai's character, Jamie,
yeah,
he was despicable yeah, in the yeah, first. You hated him.
Yeah.
And then you know the whole stuff with Brienne, with Gwendolyn, where you kind of, and then you kind of go as a punter, you're watching, kind of going, oh, maybe I was a bit hasty here. There could be a chink of humanity in this guy. And then you know, so there was things shifting all along, you know.
I was just going to say, I think I actually said that to him in Monaco. I said, look, I really wanted to hate you. And then I really fell in love with you. We all did. And then going back to the fact you were shagging your sister. And
I know, it's insane.
But it's true. You were like, how are you rooting for this guy who's done so many despicable things? And it's all because of the woman who is heinous, but it's a woman, actually his sister.
Twin sister.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I know, it's awful, but at the same time, dramatically, you know, these things kind of put you, as a viewer, you kind of look at it and go, the cheek of them asking me to have any sort of empathy or sympathy with a guy or the girl, you know, I mean, look at Arya. When lots of young girls kind of took her as a role model, right? Because she was, you know, she's ballsy, she's tiny, and yet took them. And I went, so this is a role model? Oh yeah, she's great. Nothing can keep her down. I said, you do realize that she's actually a serial killer. She has a list of people that she's going through, murdering them as she goes along, and she's your role model. and people laugh. And that's what it is about bending perceptions, about when you're watching something like that, you kind of go, the cheek of you. And like in my case, when I was reading it, you kind of have a respect that the producers didn't make it easy for themselves. George R. R. Martin, who wrote the books, didn't make it easy for himself. He wrote characters that he didn't make easy to like or love or even have empathy with. But you kind of go, well, okay. I mean, Cersei is a horrible killer, but you kind of understand her motivation because she was completely obsessed about her children. Mm. And as a, you know, any mother watching that character, you kind of go, yeah, she's doing horrible things, but I get why she's doing them. And that's what the clever thing is, that you can watch people, how close can you get to the edge of madness while trying to protect your family or whatever it may be. And that's what's good drama. That's what good drama is.
It does. It really keeps you on your toes. And it does go back to the old adage that everyone is as they are for a reason. I tell you what, I think your character is one of the few that is consistently likable. Even you've got a slightly shady past. you endured. And I love that. I love the fact that you were in from season two right till the very end. Yeah. Did you enjoy playing that character? Was a part of you that wanted someone a bit more Machiavellian?
No. Listen, I've done the bad. Listen, but a head like this, you're going to be doing a lot of baddie roles. So to be brought in as this voice of reason, and I love the idea that he, you know, when we met him, he couldn't even read or write, and yet I love the idea of this guy from Flea Bottom, the worst, you know, slum in King's Landing, that he had more nobility and decency and loyalty about him than all the heavily educated people who are wealthy and had, you know, kings and queens and princes and lords and all that sort of stuff. And yet this guy came in and had a streak of decency in him, and he I loved us. He was more noble than most of the rest of them put together. And wasn't afraid to speak his mind to his boss, hard truths and all that stuff.
I love the subplot with him and Stannis's daughter. That was a
Shireen. Oh, they did terrible thing. They killed me. I read that in this chair I'm sitting in when they sent it down. What happened when the end of that relationship? I mean, if anybody hasn't watched it yet, I don't. There's about four people out there still haven't watched it yet, so I'm not going to give too much away, just in case. But I was in floods of tears reading what happened in that, you know. And then when we came to, I'll give you a laugh. I did a terrible thing to my daughter. I'm well known as a thief on the set. I'm the most successful thief from Game of Thrones set. I've stuff all over the house that I stole. From set, but one of the things I got was I don't know if you remember, but I carved Shireen a stag. So I gave my daughter this burnt stag, obviously just after we'd finished filming, which wasn't going to hit the TV until months and months later. So when I gave it to her, my daughter in our room upstairs has her wall of awesome. She keeps all her stuff, all her nerdy stuff, big nerd. She's a video game designer, big nerd. When the episode came on, I obviously wasn't there when they were filming it. I'd read it about a year before and brokenhearted, and I wasn't there when they filmed it because, for obvious reasons, I'm not part of the scene. But when it was coming on, I went, I said, "Do you remember the stag I gave you?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "It's probably a good idea to get it now." She said, "What do you mean?" And she went, I said, "Go on, just get it." I'd completely slipped my mind what was about to happen. And she had the actual stag, burnt stag in her hand. The stag, yeah, the stag. I got two stags. They were carved one on the burnt one for the following season. And I said, "Go and get your stag." And she sat there with the stag in her hand as Shireen is walking. And when I was watching it, my eyes were filling up, and I looked down the end of the. So I just realized all of a sudden, oh my God, I just gave my own daughter the stag. And she was down in the end, inconsolable, dying on the sofa. And I felt like I'd beaten my daughter up. It was terrible.
How old was she watching it?
Well, she's 27 now. So she was like what, 24? She wasn't a kid. But she idolized the show. I know, yeah.
I tell you what, I probably sobbed in that scene, and it just actually made me stop any kind of loyalty or rooting for Stannis in that very moment.
Yeah.
There's nothing he can do now that will win me back over.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah. I know that. Well, that's what
Davos stayed loyal to him.
Yeah, he did his job. Yeah. Well, he didn't want to go. He didn't want to go. He did try and fight him. He was shouted at to leave. He knew something was up. But you gotta play the piper.
So, how much are you aware of the bigger picture when you're filming these scenes? How aware are you of everything else that's going on and pulling together? It's the first time that you actually see it in its entirety when it's broadcast.
Yeah, I see it the same time. Listen, we get up, we set our, because you know, Sky did the simulcast.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were on at whatever, 2 o'clock in the morning, I think, the 6 episodes. I'd seen the first one because I went to New York for the premiere. That was huge, mental. We took over Radio City there. It's very strange. Anyway, for the next five ones after I flew back, in our house, we all watch it on the sofa. My youngest is kind of 19 now. So we all set our alarms for like 1:15 in the morning. We came down in our Winsiette pajamas and our nighties and our toweling robes, bleary-eyed with our hair out that way. At 2 o'clock in the morning, and we watched it live. We watched it the same as everybody else at 2 o'clock in the morning. 6 of us in the south inside.
And how do you feel watching it back? Like, it obviously must be immense amount of pride. Is there an element of surprise? Are you as taken aback as we are as the fans of the show?
Oh well, I know everything. I mean, you know, there's I wouldn't do a job where I wasn't in full possession of like the scripts. You know, there's probably quite a few Hollywood movies where, you know, people are coming in doing 2-3 days, that's all they're given because they're so scared about the story getting out, and they were scared with ours as well, but they paid us the courtesy of I have always had all the scripts. I knew exactly what was going to happen before, from day one of shooting, so you know what's going to happen, but you don't know how they're going to shoot it, you don't know how it's going to be acted, you don't know how, you know, what music is going to be on top of it. So it's like layers, you know. We know the story. We know how it's going to... It's, you know, it's a bit like people who read the books. You know what's kind of going to transpire. But you love seeing other people's imaginations being layered on top of it, you know. So that was it.
Absolutely brilliant.
Always enjoyable.
Brilliant stuff. And so what next for you, work-wise?
Obscurity.
Stop it. That's never going to happen.
I have a couple of things coming out. I've just been working for Mr. Sky. I've been in Chinatown. Thank God I finished. I've been doing a really interesting thing in Rome, in Cinecittà Studios, which is the famous Federico Fellini and Sergio Leone used to film in Rome. It's a thing called Domina that is a Sky production. And it is ancient Rome, but told from the perspective of the women, which is really interesting. Because there were, as we know, incredibly powerful women operating in a very patriarchal society. So it's a 10-part series. And I play the father of the lead lady in it, Livia.
Amazing.
So they're on hiatus now because of the coronavirus, and they've had to stop production. They had to stop shooting. I finished all my stuff literally at Christmas time. So all my stuff was done then, but God love them. They still have to finish the piece. However, one other thing that I did finish, which will be out later on just after summer. Excuse me. That's a pano raison earlier on. Sorry about that. I love a heist movie, right? Bank robbing movie.
Yes.
So with the lovely Freddie Highmore, you know, The Good Doctor and yes. Bates Motel, all that. Very boyish looking, gorgeous guy. I've known him since he was about 9. His mother used to be my agent years and years and years ago. And so we are robbing the bank of Spain. We're robbing the bank in Madrid, in the central bank. So I'm doing a heist movie on the streets of Madrid. So we finished that. I think there's a trailer on YouTube. However, it's not in English. It's me with a dubbed Spanish. I don't know why. But it's called Way Down. But it's a proper heist movie. Lots of guns, lots of zip lines, all that sort of stuff, you know. So I'm looking forward.
You do love a heist. What, you won a BAFTA with Michael Fassbender, didn't you? For your
for a heist. To go Pitch Black heist. Yeah. I think you can see that on YouTube. But I think you can see that for nothing. It's really well worth seeing. We won the BAFTA for best short for that. And it's really good. It's very funny. Michael's fantastic in it. And it's a little 10-minute long thing. And I think you can find it. It's in black and white. Don't adjust your laptop. And it's really good. And BAFTA liked it and gave us the award for it. Yeah.
And Michael, another F1 fan. Let's talk about your passion for Formula One. Where on earth did it come from?
Yeah. Actually, I had passion for race. That came from. It was either be an actor. It's much cheaper to be an actor than a Formula One driver. Although you can possibly make more money acting. I love technology. I love engineering. You know, my background is engineering. And again, the circus thing, the collaborative thing. I had this, and it's incredibly glamorous, you know, as well. Which is a bit like Hollywood. I don't know, maybe it's like, I don't know, maybe it's my mindset or whatever. But I was very blessed. I ended up in the paddock because of Bernie Eccleston. A lot of people think it was because, you know, as a friend of Eddie Jordan. I became a friend of Eddie through Bernie. And I did a beautiful, for any of your viewers out there, especially the dads, because there's not many dad-daughter movies. I did a beautiful movie with Alfonso Cuarón, who did Gravity. And won the Oscar. Didn't he win the Oscar for Roma and all that? Anyway, fantastic director. And I did this daddy-daughter movie, which is Frances Hodgson Burnett, Secret Garden, all that. And it's a parent-daughter movie, single parent. And it's one of the most glorious things I've ever done. A beautiful movie. And we had a royal premiere in London. So Sarah Ferguson at the time, Andrew's ex. She was part of the charity, and she said, there's another guy here you probably don't know him, Bernie Eccleston. And I went, what? Said, do you want to meet him? And I went, yeah. So I went over, and he literally got the napkin, and he said, are you looking forward to the new season? I said, yeah. He said, you got to many races? I said, I've never been to a race. And he literally took the napkin out, put his number down on it, and said, any Grand Prix you ever want to go to, just call that number.
And how long ago?
That was 24 years ago.
Wow.
And I use it every year. I use it all the time. I did about five a year. I've managed to get my addiction down to about three. But I still get up, like, you know, Chinese races, Japanese races. I watch qualifying. I get up at 4 a.m. to watch the qualifying. I'm a silly nerd. Yeah, love it.
What was the film called? The father daughter one.
Oh, A Little Princess.
A Little Princess. Okay.
Yeah, it's a beautiful movie. Patrick Doyle did the music. You know, did the wonderful, wonderful British composer. His daughter sings on it and all sorts of stuff. It's gorgeous, gorgeous movie. It'll have you in tears.
Well,
it's great.
I've scribbled that down. I don't need to cry anymore. Every single thing that comes on the telly at the moment, I'm just...
Oh, sorry. I'll have you on floods of tears on this, Natalie, I promise you. Oh. But for all the right reasons. Okay. It's a weepy, a good weepy.
So, obviously, this season, you know, like every other live sport, is just, you know, hanging...
Catastrophe.
It's very sad. Obviously, there are much bigger things at stake, but... Do you think, kind of, coronavirus aside, what do you think about the current state of Formula One, and who kind of excites you? Who are you kind of? I know that you come to a lot of the races as a guest of Mercedes or Ferrari. They're the two teams that you follow closely.
Yeah. And Racing Point, don't forget. Force India, Racing Point, Eddie Jordan. I've watched that go right through, and Andy Stevenson would kill me if I don't give him a mention. Yeah, no. They've been very kind to me, other people at Racing, or Aston Martin, as they're going to be called now.
Exactly.
That's lovely. I wonder will they change it? Yeah, I'd love to see a green car out there, an Aston Martin green Formula One car. How sexy would that be? That would be gorgeous. British Racing Green on the tarmac. How lovely.
Any car at all would do me. I don't care. Yeah. We're getting withdrawal symptoms. Anyway, which drivers have really caught your attention?
Oh, well, listen, obviously, Max is maturing into a machine, a nuclear weapon of a driver. And he still drives like he's 17. He will not, if he sees a gap, he'll put the car on its side to get it through. And I love that. And it's the same with Lewis. One of the things, Lewis can be, he's fantastic. Look, he's well on the road to becoming a legend. He's a magnificent multiple world champion, but I don't use the word legend much. There's very few of them in Formula One, but he's that close to it. What I love about Lewis is that if he's leading from the front, when Mercedes are at their best and they just go off into the distance, when he comes back in, it's the car, it's the this, that, and the other, everything came together, the usual this, that, and the other, which is understandable. But when he's got a fight on his hands, when Lewis comes back in after having a row with Max or whoever it may be, or Seb, you can see his eyes are what he loves a fight. Lewis, and that's right, I used to love that about Nigel Mansell. I always said it's terrible. It's probably a terrible thing to say. I don't think I'd be delighted to be locked in a lift with Nigel Mansell. But put him in a racing car. There's a reason the Italians call him the British Lion. He's just relentless. He's like a dog with a bone in a car. He's a racer. And there's many of them there that aren't racers. But you know, Lewis is a, you know, dyed in the wool. It's in his bones that he's a racer. And I love that. I love that about him. It's just that driven thing to win. So Lewis is, look, he's a godlike stature now at this stage. Max is getting there. If Honda come up with the engine this year, you know, and Adrian has the right, you know, the right bits on the car. And Charles Leclerc is very dangerous. Just one or two things going to happen with Seb. Seb is either going to, you know, match the fight and pull something out, or it's going to go the other way. I would like to think that Seb's a racer as well. Seb's a proper racer. You know, you're not four times world champion just because you've got a good car under your ass. He's proper. He's proper. And I would love to see Seb step up to the plate if Ferrari have got their few bits and pieces together with this car. And I know there was a lot of talk at the beginning of the season that the car doesn't seem to be working out as well as they would have hoped. I do not like this push-pull steering wheel on a Mercedes. I think it's obscene. I don't like it. It's against the spirit of the racing.
I like the fact
that... But I said that about the halo. I said that about the halo as well.
Yeah, you're a purist. You don't like any change, but you get used to it very quickly.
Yeah. No, I do like change. I like innovation. But this, push the wheel to make... It's not. It's aesthetically vile, but anyway.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Listen, one thing that we've been doing on Sky F1, and actually, it would be wicked to get you on one of our. We do like these weekly panels with Formula One for Sky F1.
Yeah.
So come on, one of those.
Yeah.
Your top five drivers of all time.
Yeah.
Can you do that on the spot? Can you? I think
now, yeah.
Yeah.
I loved Mika Häkkinen. I've got a soft place in my heart for Mika. Because, I mean, there was quite a few quotes from that Häkkinen was the only man that Michael Schumacher was afraid of. Allegedly. Look, I didn't hear Michael saying it, but he was wonderful. Mika, there's something so pure about him, and he has that naughty Scandinavian thing which he gracefully handed on to Kimi. Kimi is, I love Kimi. I love Kimi for all the mad reasons. He's I mean, you guys, you must make your guys' job hell. But there's something unpretentious about the man. And he has a wickedly black sense of humor. There's a great video of him with him drunk at the award thing with the Ferrari thing when he was drunk on stage. The dude was at a party. He's supposed to drink. Just don't invite him up on stage. You guys are the people that made the mistake. Don't invite him up on stage. Don't give him drink and then invite him up on stage. Invite him up on stage, then give him the drink. If you, it's your own fault. And I just love that. There's no BS with the guy. And I know he's treating.
Where can we find this?
It's on YouTube. Just have a look. It's easy.
Drunk.
It was some awards ceremony. He's not obnoxious or anything like that. But you can tell that he's got a few on him. Oh, it's funny. It's funny as hell. And he's hanging out with Seb, who's trying to keep proceedings together. It's great. And I love that. I used to watch the tennis when you had Vitas Gerulaitis, John McEnroe, and Ilya Nastasi, all these maniacs who were playing. In a sense, the sport became so professional when there was so much money came in, and they're magnificent. Like, I mean, you look at Federer, and various, and the same with the ladies. Is that they're sport machines. They're brilliant at what they do. They're incredibly clever. But you miss a bit of a personality. You miss a bit of, you miss a bit of falling over drunk. You miss a few F words, F bombs thrown around here and there. And Kimi still has that. He's the last of the old school, really. And he's a proper racer, When he checked, when he got his world championship, he went off and started rallying, And then before he came back, and loves being in a car, loves, very in tune with it. I was lucky enough. You're talking about top five. I do ramble. Do apologize.
Love it.
When I was a guest of Mercedes at Monaco a couple of years ago, myself and Fassbender. And we were up on the Pratt perch above the garages. And it was the first time it was, I've actually got a photograph somewhere. I have the last close-up photograph of Michael Schumacher I was on the grid. And I have the last photograph, because he just took off after we left the grid, of a close-up of Michael in his helmet for his last ever Monaco that I took. And I have that somewhere. But I was lucky enough, Ross Brawn, they gave us the headsets. So I had the actual team headsets on while Michael was racing. And I listened to Schumacher in the car as he was going around during the race. It was the most extraordinary thing. I thought it was a tape recording. He's just so calm. He was so calm in the car, just going, it was like he was an engineer on the wall. He was asking what tires various people were along the track. Is anybody coming up here further ahead? He's constantly talking. In Monaco, where there's no room for error. And he's talking like he's not even driving the car. He wasn't out of breath. He didn't seem to be struggling in any shape or form. And I'm kind of going, is this for real? It was the first time. It was a real, really spoiled. But myself, Fassbender was there that year, and the two of us were just kind of looking at each other going, how is he physically capable? It's not just, this is the information, how close am I to the guy in front? This is like constantly working out the strategy in the car with the engineers in real time. I found that absolutely extraordinary, that and his physical well-being inside this car that's doing this at 180, 90 miles an hour. That's extraordinary. So you can't, anybody's list, you can't leave Schumacher off.
No, I think that the greats are just wired differently, aren't they?
I think there is a bit of that. Yeah. They're slightly mad. In a good way, but mad. There is a madness to them. And I know Michael was incredibly driven, incredibly competitive.
I see. I think that's your five then. So you're gonna go with Mika, Nigel.
No, hold on. Oh. Nigel. Yeah, I would. I would put him in the top five. Hold on. I suppose you could do. Yeah. And I just loved Nigel when he was taken on Senna. You know, he was this gorgeous brown Brazilian guy who, you know, was touched by God and, you know, the girls loved and all that. And then you've Nigel coming in looking like a sergeant from a rural English police station. You know what I mean? With the big moustache and everything. Nigel never looked like he had a six-pack. You know what I mean? But put him in a car and he's a different creature. He was an animal in the car and wouldn't give up. And I've the utmost respect for people that do that, you know, that just won't give up, you know. Even when the brakes don't come, the next brake will come along. Maybe that'll work then. And it's that constant thing. So I think Nigel would be on the list. Yeah, yeah. Let's put Nigel on the list.
Mika, Michael, Lewis.
Kimmy. Yeah. Yeah, it's not a bad top five, I suppose. But then you've got gorgeous people like Leclerc coming up, and who's, you know, he could bust things wide open. And I love the new boys, Lando and George and all these boys, and, you know, Carlos Sainz. It's like a playground for them. It's really weird. Like they're 16 years old. It makes me feel so old looking at these kids who, in the evening, because my son watches them racing on Twitch or whatever it is, doing the virtual racing that they, you know, they've got the simulator setups in their house. And when they're not racing, they're racing in their house. It's insane. They do 24-hour races and all sorts of stuff. There's a whole new batch coming around and a new way of thinking. It'll be really, really interesting to see where this goes. Really interesting.
Look, I have loved talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. I'm sure
you're very welcome.
Plenty more time on our hands over the next few weeks, so I hope we get to
I know. It's really weird. I think we'll be lucky to get Silverstone. Just from the news and whatever, we'll be very lucky if we get Silverstone. I think even if it clears up before then, the organisation to put that together may not happen.
Well, there's some talk about the fact that because there are so many teams based in and around Silverstone, that we may use Silverstone as a racetrack, because obviously then they don't have to travel.
We can
use Silverstone as a track for more than one race this year, but just later in the year, I don't know. You know,
it takes away the spend. And listen, hold on, Sauber have to travel, Ferrari have to travel, Toro Rosso or whatever they call AlphaTauri, whatever they call this year. I know you can't even pronounce it. They have to travel.
They could
easily just stick their fingers up and go, hold on, it's okay for you guys because Cosworth is in Northampton.
We need to get racing.
We do need to get racing, but you know. Listen, fingers crossed. My missus was asking me, how long do you think? And I said, look, if this curve flattens in 2 weeks, then it's another 2 weeks to make sure it's not going to get any worse, and minimum another 2 weeks after that to see where we are before this. So I think, you know, if you're head any shorter than 6 weeks with this, I think you might be slightly delusional. Enjoy the time off. Enjoy the time with your kids if you're lucky enough to have them. If not, go out and do the garden, paint the house, you know, use the time. I'm telling you, in a year's time, people have been going to go, why didn't I use the time when I was off? I'm back at work now, I hate it. People have been doing that. You've wanted this. Many people in the real world have said, what would I do if I had like 2 or 3 months off? It was like people were waiting on their retirement just so they could have 3 months off. You have 3 months off. Don't whinge about it. Do what you said you were going to do, apart from the travel. But do your bits and pieces. Get to know your family again, even if it's on Zoom.
The motivational speeches of the day from Liam Cunningham.
Correct. I'll probably be totally depressed tomorrow night.
No. Thank you so much for your company. It's lovely to see you.
Nice talking to you, Natalie. Oh, it was a pleasure. Never a chore.
Thank you, Liam Cunningham, for that chat. Absolutely fascinating stuff. I always think it's really interesting hearing from someone who's outside of Formula One looking in, and particularly someone like Liam, who has loved the sport pretty much his whole life and been involved coming to the sport for like over 25 years, watching drivers come and go and being affiliated with various teams. So thank you for that unique insight, Mr. Cunningham. And also, how about that inside scoop on Game of Thrones? I'm a massive fan of the series, and it was just great to hear what kind of went on behind the scenes of the epic series on HBO. Thank you also for your company, not just for Liam's podcast, but throughout this series. I know it's a really strange time for everyone, so it's so important for us to stay connected, to keep talking. So give me all your feedback. Let me know who else you want me to talk to. Any questions that you've got for guests coming up. Who else have we got coming on the way? Will Greenwood's coming back again, as is Daniel Ricciardo. And we've got Johnny Bairstow. We've got the editor of Hello Magazine, Rosie Nixon, Gethin Jones, and Kate Thornton. So a real mixture of characters on the way on In the Pink, and more chances to win those Bose noise cancelling headphones. Tag in a friend, let us know what you've been up to during lockdown, and add the hashtag Bose, and we will pick a few more winners at random and post those out to you. But for now, thanks again for your company, and I will speak to you very soon. Bye bye for now. Stay safe, stay home, stay connected.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.